This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Our panel of writers is ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Shalom.
We've got lots to get to on today's show. I hope you'll stick around for some stories later in the program about some important developments in global military and weapons development, some stories you're not likely to hear about from any mainstream news source. But we're going to start the program with news out of Parkland, Florida, a very tough story that happened this week, another school shooting, 17 people killed, 14 injured, in the ninth deadliest shooting in American history. I found out that one of the victims was a 14-year-old girl, same age as one of my daughters, and she was an Irish dancer. We were just down in Orlando for a regional competition in December, and the school that she belonged to had many dancers at that competition. So I was just thinking about all of the kids that were running around in the halls and dancing on those stages, and I don't think that girl was in the competition that we were at. But this is the world that our kids are growing up in. They're dealing with these kinds of tragedies fairly regularly. I was even just struck by watching the footage of the way that these kids handled it. And just the fact that you have the protocols in place in all of these schools where what to do in an active shooter situation, that this is basically, you know, I remember having, tornado drills or nuclear bomb drills when I was in school, where we would get under the desks or we would meet at a certain location. And today it's school shooting that, schools have to prepare themselves for. When tragedies like this happen, the difference between the Trumpet and other news sources, I think, really becomes plain. Everybody wants to prevent something like this from happening again. And so how do we deal with the causes of this kind of a tragedy? And everything that we're hearing in the mainstream conversation basically points to one cause and one solution, I would say a very ill-defined solution, and that is gun control. And that argument is getting louder and louder. But in this country, there's a strong pushback against that. It's a very politically charged subject. And it's amazing to me just how quickly the conversation turns very political after something like this. And it's almost like if someone doesn't immediately come out and say, you know, it's time to do something about gun control, then they're kind of viewed as a morally inferior person. This is kind of the moral climate that we have in the United States today. I think there is more and more a call for instant justice, like, say, in the climate of the Me Too movement, that type of thing. Where there's a certain presumption of guilt before it's proven. It's not a presumption of innocence. And I think the way that has unfolded, say, with respect to other areas in life, you definitely see the same thing thanks to social media and that kind of thing, where everybody has their very strong statements. They come out immediately saying, we have to do something about this now. And the call for action is there's a strong expectation, and one would presume even politicians are feeling the pressure to do something, whatever that thing is. And it makes you wonder just how dramatic the action is that politicians might take in order to pacify the crowd that is calling for some kind of action. But if you listen to the way that we talk about this on the Trumpet, we're not just looking at, say, a weapon or as being the cause. We're looking at deeper causes. I would really encourage people to go and listen to the program that Stephen Fleury did on the Trumpet Daily radio show on Thursday about this, where he was talking about a spiritual dimension to this question and the fact that there is evil involved and evil spirits involved when you see people taking actions like this. And that is certainly something that not very many people would look at as a real cause. But it's if you're ignoring that, then you're really ignoring the real issue here. Andrew Miller, he's written something about another aspect of this that is a deeper cause than just the weapon that was used here. Andrew, why don't you talk about the article that you put up this week?
Yeah, it is it's quite sad how common these things are becoming, and the fact that you can almost write the biography of these school shooters before you've even done any research into them. As soon as I heard there was a school shooting, I mean, just right from the hip, I knew three things. It was like, it says, whoever did this, he's angry, he's obsessed with violence, and he didn't have a dad. And sure enough, I did the research, and he was angry, he was obsessed with violence, and he didn't have a dad. You looked into like his social media post, and I mean, he had pictures of frogs he'd killed for no good reason, and pictures of guns he had, and pictures of knives he had, and pictures of himself in mask, and threats that he was going to be a school shooter someday. I guess the one point that did surprise me a little bit in this situation is normally these school shooters are from a divorced family or from a parent who was never married. In this case, it was actually an orphan, so still no father in the home, but he was put up for adoption as a baby, had an adopted mother and father, but his adopted father died when he was six. His adopted mother died last November, and so it just becomes really evident that he didn't have any discipline or much direction or correction growing up. They're still looking into root causes, but it looks like he broke up with his girlfriend and got in a fight with her new boyfriend and was expelled for school for that. And then it was kind of like a pain of the rejection or something like that that pushed his already disturbed mind that point into just doing something horrible.
It's an important point to look at this, and the fact that you like you said, this is pretty well across the board what you see, where there's broken families, and yet you wouldn't hear someone say anything about that aspect of it as being a problem or something that, you know, if the call is like, we need to do something, you're not going to hear we need to strengthen our families, we need to make sure that fathers are more involved with their sons or that type of thing, because it's too overwhelming to do something about that. But you might hear it as, it's tragic that he experienced those kinds of conditions, but it's not, in terms of prescriptions for solutions, you're never going to hear that brought into the equation.
Yeah, almost never from any mainstream media source, actually. I do quote in this article one sociologist, Brad Wilcox. He's a professor at University of Virginia who leads, I think, the National Marriage Initiative. Not a lot of people listen to him, but he's someone I go to quite a bit for his articles for statistics on things like this, because he's fairly unique amongst criminologists in that he doesn't focus on prison reform or drug reform or things like that. He said, if we can get the family right, these problems take care of themselves. And there is a quote in that article online there where he says, as the nation seeks to make sense of these senseless shootings, we must also face the uncomfortable truth that turmoil at home all too often accounts for the turmoil we end up seeing spill into our streets and schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brent.
Yeah, it's just interesting you bring up this question between whether this is a cultural reality rather than just an accessibility to guns type thing. I just walked down the street today here in Israel, in Jerusalem, guy walking with a pair of shorts, flip-flops on, massive machine gun over his shoulder. I didn't flinch because I've lived here for so long. That's just a reality in this country. And yes, I think it might be a bit harder to get a weapon, but there are weapons absolutely everywhere in this country. And yet you don't see these mass shootings in schools, or these mass shooting epidemic that we see in the United States. And this is just anecdotal, but you walk around Jerusalem and much of Israel, and family is greatly prized as an institution still in this country. Very much so. It's even surprised me just seeing how many people go back, even if they're not religious, back home every Friday night for the weekend, and spend time with their physical families. So here we have access to guns in this country, and there's no mass shootings. So it must be something other than just the access to weaponry.
Right, and guns have been available for a long time. I guess the question that people point to is the fact that you have these more high-powered guns, AR-15s, that these are often involved, and there may be questions about what type of gun should be available. But to address questions like that and to ignore these larger questions, the fact that we're really suffering from the bad effects of having undermined the institution of family, undermined parental involvement in children's lives, and had this rise in violence and macabre content in our entertainment, those kinds of things, those questions just tend to get pushed aside in favor of something that's more tangible and physical. I mean, I do feel like the idea that whatever the problem that we human ingenuity can solve it, that's our natural tendency is to want to have material explanations for whatever problem that we're facing, and not considering spiritual causes and spiritual solutions. That's very much a common denominator anytime you have people who are addressing these kinds of problems in society.
Yeah, I totally agree with all that's been said. And I think that another often overlooked factor in all of this is psychiatric medication, mind-altering drugs with side effects known to include homicidal ideation and suicidal intentions printed right there on the bottle. Nicholas Cruz was on medications to deal with his emotional fragility. And Adam Lanza, back in 2013, the Newtown, Connecticut shooter, he was heavily medicated. One of the Columbine shooters was heavily medicated, the Las Vegas shooter as well, and many others have been on these mind-altering drugs. So I don't know if these medications are causal, or maybe these are just people that are known to have a lot of emotional fragility and psychiatric problems. But the side effects of these meds can be very serious. And I think the fact that this aspect of these tragic stories is almost always ignored by the mainstream media is curious and disturbing.
Well, you're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to get now into the first of our stories about military matters. NATO defense ministers met this week. They want to establish two new NATO headquarters, one in the U.S., one in Germany. But there's some tension between these two powers over the future of this alliance and how much they really want to direct their military resources toward it. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so they agreed on this this command center. And I think this is something really interesting that's emerged out of Europe over the last year or so. Is all of a sudden, everybody's gotten very serious about rapid movement across Europe, getting troops quickly. So the European Union has begun its own initiatives on it's called a military Schengen, to try and sort out all the paperwork, to kind of form European-wide maps and plans of bridges that are strong enough to hold tanks, etc., so that they can have routes all pre-planned out, ready to go as soon as something comes up. The Netherlands, as part of the PESCO agreements that we've been talking about, has started this brand new agreement or initiative to try and get European troops within the European Union moving quickly. And now Germany this week the defense ministers approved a new command center for Germany to take the lead now within Germany to help NATO troops move quickly throughout Europe. So a very strong emphasis on this. And then, as you said, I think what's interesting, there's a couple of kind of interesting stories that all come together around the same time. So German Foreign Policy had a good article on this. I think they've only just... This is one. It was initially only available in German, but they've translated it now. It's called Transatlantic Rivals. And it talks about this new headquarters. It goes into some of the details and shows how actually this isn't quite so firmly inbuilt into the NATO command structure as, say, some other things. It's set up in such a way that it's still under German sovereignty. And if Germany wants, they could use this command center for other purposes. Hmm. So instead of being a NATO headquarters, it could become a European headquarters. So I think that flexibility is interesting. And then they also draw attention to the fact that some people in the U.S. are now starting to warn that there's a danger of Europe going its own way without the United States.
Right.
And this, I mean, this is something we've been talking about in quite dramatic terms for years, and we've not really heard a peep out of the U.S. on this. And now, I mean, it's definitely not, say, this big outcry, and I don't think they see the full danger of the situation. But you are now seeing some individuals come out and saying, well, hang on a minute. Europe is starting to go its own way. We're not really sure that's a great idea. And it could be dangerous for us in the long run.
So it is interesting to hear these kinds of concerns coming from U.S. officials when they've just been saying over and over again how much Germany needs to militarize, that the Europeans need to be taking care of their own defenses, all of the concerns that they have that they're not doing enough. What is it that they're looking at here and saying, wait a minute, we're not quite comfortable with the direction this is taking?
Well, a lot of it they're talking about is just this kind of an independence from NATO. So they're partly worried, you know, NATO for the EU has been this great vehicle for them to get America to help with military projects that they want. But at the same time, it's also had at times it's been advantageous for the US as a way to get European nations on board with projects they want, like Afghanistan. They could do it through NATO, get more than the NATO help, the idea that it's not the United States acting alone. And so they're worried that if Europe kind of goes its own way on defense, then NATO could wither and die, and it's not going to be as interested in putting resources into NATO. So,
which is interesting because in light of, say, conversations that we've had, Angela Merkel saying, well, we're going to need to start taking care of our own, that we can't trust the United States so much. There's been this discussion of the severing or at least the fracturing of this alliance between Germany and the United States, between European nations and the United States. As far as I can tell, this is the first time that there's been this kind of overtly expressed concern by Americans about that. I mean, Donald Trump was even famously saying, well, NATO is obsolete. We need to move away from this alliance anyway. It seems like for them to be making these statements now, I can't imagine that Europe would be all that terribly concerned to be hearing this.
Right. And yeah, I agree. It is. I was kind of surprised. Like, oh, really? Like, now you're waking up to this?
Right, right.
Actually, I did like, it was the director of Carnegie Europe, Thomas Vavasek. He responded to some of these and he said, he said it's too late. He said that ship has already sailed.
Yeah.
You know, Europe's moving forward to defense integration. I think this is something we're going to hear a lot more about this weekend. Because probably, well, actually, yeah, starting about the same time that this program goes out, you have the Munich Security Conference starting. Mm. And this is a conference that is all about transatlantic security. So top defense experts from Europe and the United States getting together and in theory discussing the defense problems that affect them both. It's had some dramatic moments over the years. You know, we drew a big attention to some of the comments at, I think it was the 2014 Munich Security Conference, where Germany came and announced we're taking a new direction in their military. And after that, sure enough, they did start getting much more involved in North Africa and the Middle East. So they're meeting this weekend. And I think this is going to be the top item on the agenda. You know, there's a lot of speeches lined up about European defense. And I think we'll see a lot of talk, maybe some significant announcements, but definitely a lot of talk about Europe doing more. But there's already a lot of talk about the split between America. So, for example, Wolfgang Ischinger, he's the... he really organizes this conference. He's in charge of this conference. He talked about the emancipation of the European Union from America. Now, he did say peaceful emancipation, but he's talking in unprecedented terms about a break with the United States. Norbert Rotinger, he's the Christian Democratic Union chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the German Parliament. This was last month. He said, as Europeans, we must develop the ability, unity, and strength sometimes to settle a conflict with the USA. So you get a Europe talking in terms that they've never really talked about. This time last year with the Munich Security Conference, you know, Mike Pence was there. General Mattis was there. And they were there really trying to shore up the transatlantic alliance, try and say, well, the election of Donald Trump didn't change anything. And that kind of dominated the narrative. People were kind of, I think, surprised about how pro-NATO the comments from these two individuals were. They're not there this time. And I think it's instead going to be this complete breakdown in the alliance that's going to dominate the discussion. It's going to be a discussion of, is it a long term? Is it a short term? But yes, you're really seeing a strong split between the two.
So I'm just thinking about the He Was Right booklet. I believe this booklet that we've assembled all of the information about what Herbert W. Armstrong prophesied over the years based on what is prophesied in the Bible. Transatlantic rift, this division between the United States and Europe, was something that he talked about for a long time. We're seeing this finally develop in a tangible way here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether you got transatlantic shift from the He Was Right book. I can't remember if we used that headline, but that was the headline of a Carnegie Europe article just this week. So it is exactly what's happening. I think it's also something, you know, this is back in September, October, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had an article drawing attention to the German election crisis. And this was where he went with that look, Europe's going through some transformations. Look how anti-American certain politicians were, how anti-Donald Trump certain politicians were in that election campaign. Europe's going through a big change. And we've seen that whole chaos kind of drag out. And at the same time, we're just seeing that anti-Americanism and this rift just intensify.
Yeah, Andrew.
Yeah, it is just amazing just how much that would change the geopolitical scene, too, because a lot of the early founding fathers of the European Union were really big on the idea that we need both the United States and the European Union to kind of surrender sovereignty to each other to form like this Western civilization bloc that could stand against the Eastern civilization, the communist threat at the time. And then you get this emancipation of Europe where that becomes a whole new trade bloc on its own that does give them something that's prophesied, that if that bloc even temporarily aligns with that Eastern bloc against America, the U.S. is no longer the superpower by any means after that.
Well, you can go online to thetrumpet.com and look at our booklet. He Was Right. One of the chapters is, in fact, titled Atlantic Rift, talking about this specifically and why Herbert W. Armstrong made that prediction that you would see a division between the United States and Europe. He was right. Thanks for that, Richard. A couple of related stories. We've been following the increase in European interest in getting involved in the Middle East, with conflict roiling in Syria, tensions over Jerusalem increasing, conflict building between Iran and Israel. To learn the latest of how Europe is reacting, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
There's a really interesting piece in Deutsche Welle this week, German publication, or their website, and it interviews a Middle East and Africa expert at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. It's a think tank in Berlin. And it goes through a number of scenarios relating to what's just taken place between Israel and Iran. Last week, we've talked a lot about that on this program, and how that there is a coming war that seems inevitable between Israel and Iran, with Syria, southern Lebanon, being the battlefront for it, as Iran keeps on trying to use its advantage now with troops on the ground in Syria and in southern Lebanon to push at Israel. And this article, this editorial, is entitled, Could Germany Act as Mediator Between Israel and Iran? It's a really interesting point. that it brings out here, because right now we don't really see too much of Germany in the Middle East as far as at least being a decisive factor with these nations. And yet this author comes out and says Germany could fulfill that role perfectly.
So what is it that he is looking at? What is it about Germany that makes him think that it would make an ideal mediator in this situation?
Well, I'll just quote him. That might be easiest. He says right at the end here, "I think the EU, and specifically in this case Germany, have a unique potential. It is both a strategic ally of Israel, and at the same time it enjoys some level of access or reliability from Iran. Germany is the only actor in the Western world that has some practical experience at mediating informal agreements between Israel, Iran, and Hezbollah. Back in the past, they've mediated a number of prisoner exchanges between Hezbollah and Israel, both in 96 and 2004. And then he says, so it has the know-how, the capacities, and a huge interest to stop this cycle of escalation. The shockwave of a third war in the region would have an impact over the Mediterranean. In Lebanon alone, there's 1.5 million refugees who, in the case of war, might be knocking at Europe's doors." So he's seeing this as the almost inevitability of Israel going to war with Iran, because Iran pushes and doesn't, is not going to stop, as a necessity for somebody to get involved and stop that from escalating, because Germany is going to suffer the consequences. This, if it gets violent in Western Syria, Eastern Israel, if it gets violent in Southern Lebanon, you're going to have millions more refugees that are going to need somewhere to go. And he's saying Germany is uniquely qualified to go in there and broker something between Iran, Israel, maybe even Syria and Israel. I think that might be more likely than a Iran-Israel agreement.
Pretty good sign he's never picked up a Trumpet magazine. If he's saying Germany needs to be getting involved, I mean, we, looking at it from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, we know that Germany is going to get involved because of Iranian provocations, and it's not going to enter as a mediator. So more information also just about France kind of taking a look at what's going on down here and saying, well, we might want to get involved as well.
Right, so you have the French president coming out and saying this week or Tuesday that France will strike any chemical weaponry facilities if Assad does use chemical weapons again. It's proven that he's used them again. Then France is going to make a strike on those locations in Syria. And so, I mean, he has said this before, but he has confirmed that it's a red line just this week. It's interesting, I think, because you have to see Assad as somebody that, while we talk about the Iranians as kind of fanatical, the regime in Iran, it's religious fanaticism. You look at Hezbollah, that's religious fanaticism that drives them as well. And you have Syria in the middle that is an ally of Iran. And yet Bashar al-Assad isn't a religious fanatic. He is doing whatever he can to clutch onto power. And if he sees much more increased pressure such as this from France, or even if Germany says, no, we can't let a war take place between Iran and Israel and be on your turf, maybe he would be willing to flip sides. I know I'm saying might sound crazy, but if Europe puts the money where their mouth is, finally, eventually in Syria, we might see them start to tug at Assad, saying, hey, we might allow you to stay if you get rid of Iran there, because Europeans are mainly worried about Iran. And that's what Bible prophecy says will happen. Not necessarily that it's going to be a peace negotiation that comes up between Europe and Syria or Assad, but the Bible does indicate that Syria is going to fall out of the Iranian orbit. Even as crazy as that sounds to say right now, that is what's going to happen. And that's why we watch any type of European intervention or talk of intervening inside Syria.
It's an interesting perspective, and one that really would only come from Bible prophecy. You know, considering how much Assad has heard and ignored other red lines given by Western leaders regarding his weapons program. But it will be interesting to watch how that unfolds. Will it be different having come from the French president as opposed to some of these other leaders? How will Assad respond to that? Where would you send people to learn more about that, Brent?
Well, I would just go back to get our fundamental look on the Syrian crisis, Syrian civil war. The article by our editor-in-chief entitled How the Syrian Crisis Will End, written back in 2012. We hold to that analysis in that article because it's based on Bible prophecy. Everyone else has an idea of how Syria is going to end. That will guide you to show you what the Bible says.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll get into a few alarming stories about some nuclear weapons technology in development. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Nuclear weapons are the ultimate doomsday device, and nuclear warfare is a real concern in this era of weapons proliferation. You put what you see with weapons manufacturing and arms trade together with biblical prophecies of fire devouring cities, cities without inhabitant, and you know there is real cause for concern. Scientists in China appear to be developing technology that could make the fallout from a nuclear weapon far worse. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
The Chinese Academy of Sciences made this announcement early this week, and they said that some of their officials at their heavy ion research facility in the city of Lanzhou had successfully fired superheated beams of a certain radioactive isotope of tantalum. Tantalum is it's a heavy metal that's kind of easy to ignore when you're looking at the periodic table, number 73 there in the middle of that huge block of transition metals, and just kind of off to the corner of that huge block. But it has been called the most important element that you've never heard of. And that's in part because of the destructive capacity of some of its isotopes. And tantalum-181 is really the big one there. It could be added to a nuclear warhead to make a highly radioactive salted bomb, which would make, as you said, nuclear fallout much more devastating to the area beneath the detonation than a standard nuclear weapon. And that's the very isotope that these Chinese scientists are working to weaponize right now. In their announcement about this, the Academy said that their scientists had accelerated the ionized atoms of tantalum-181 to record levels, and they'd been able to repeat it several times. And they also said that the project has direct military applications.
So what military applications does it have? How is this military advantageous to create worse fallout? And what does it say about China's ambitions that they're doing that?
Well, it's basically, China has, they've long been focusing on ramping up the size and power of their nuclear arsenal. And one of the goals that they've often stated is being able to achieve a high level of nuclear deterrence with a comparatively small nuclear arsenal. So if they were able to develop salted bombs, that would really play into this strategy. Salted bombs, it's named after a strategy dating back to medieval times, when a conquering power would actually salt the agricultural lands of people that they had conquered. And it was just kind of used to show that the victor wanted to totally eradicate these people and even their ability to rebuild and regrow.
Scorched earth.
Exactly. Yes. So salted bombs such as those that would be infused with tantalum-181 have that same goal in mind, really, but on a much more destructive scale, because instead of salt, they would be raining massive amounts of radioactive fallout onto the land. So it would be able to kill far more people.
So I mentioned those prophecies about cities without inhabitant. Maybe you could just elaborate on why we would be watching something like this so closely.
Yes. Well, about 2,000 years ago, the disciples of Jesus Christ asked him what would be the sign of his return and the sign of the end of the age, or the end of the world, really. That's recorded in Matthew 24, verse 3. And there's a lot packed into this chapter. But in verses 21 and 22, Christ speaks of a specific war that will occur that signifies that the end of the age of man is imminent and that his return is right at the door. He said, quote, "There will be greater anguish than at any time since the world began. It'll never be so great again. In fact, unless that time of calamity is shortened, not a single person will survive." That's how it's written in the New Living Translation. And At the time that Christ spoke those words, a global war that could threaten to kill every single person was just not technologically possible.
Right.
You know, in that age of Roman rule, warfare was hand-to-hand combat with swords and spears and things like that. The closest thing to a weapon of mass destruction would have been a catapult or maybe a really skilled archer on top of a war elephant or something like that. And for hundreds and hundreds of years, the situation was basically the same. Mankind just didn't have the weaponry to wipe out all life from Earth. But around the year 1955, a major prophetic milestone was crossed. At that time, enough atomic and nuclear weapons had been developed so that a war capable of extinguishing all life from Earth was for the first time possible and even dangerously probable. And today, of course, we continue to hold each other at nuclear gunpoint. And if China is developing these tantalum-181 laced nuclear bombs, then that just adds even more to mankind's ability to wipe out all life from Earth, just as, or all human life from Earth, just as Christ said, we will come very close to doing in World War III.
Mm-hmm. And it reminds me too of the new booklet that Gerald Fleury produced this last year, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. That talks about some of those prophecies, including those that you just mentioned in Matthew 24 and others that that show we really are, we need to be concerned about these weapons actually being used. Whenever mankind produces a weapon, we find some way to put it into action. And this is one where we've kind of been waiting for the penny to drop for a long time. But as you see these technologies developing, becoming even deadlier, you know that that it's not something that you can afford to overlook and ignore for much longer. Well, we'll put a link to that booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, in the show notes to the program today, as well as the other articles and literature that we've discussed. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. Meanwhile, Iran just unveiled some new homemade nuclear-capable ballistic missiles. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Nachtigall.
So just a day after the Iranians let that drone fly into Israeli territory, which started this whole showdown over Syria in Syrian skies, we had them parade a newly developed missile, ballistic missile, medium-range ballistic missile in Tehran. This is a Qadr missile. It's one that is capable of carrying a nuclear weapon. No, it's not an ICBM, but it's definitely one that can reach Israel, then off maybe into parts of southeastern Europe. And we had just a couple days after that, basically just the timing of this is interesting. Obviously, the Iranians knew when they were going to fly their drone into Israel. And then at the same time, they come out and they're releasing a new ballistic missile that says this can hit Israel. And so people should be asking, well, does Iran want to reach Israel with this bomb? And I think Iran is making that threat. At the same time, a couple of days later, there was the leader of Iran's Quds Force. This is a branch of the Iranian government, and this is what he is saying. This is Qassem Soleimani. We are never forgetful, and there is no night we sleep without thinking about the enemies. The conducts of the regime, that is Israel, show that it will not last, as there are no signs indicating its survival. So here we have somebody provoking a nation, provoking war against Israel. Day later, showing a nuclear-capable ballistic missile that looks very similar to what the North Koreans are doing, or North Koreans have produced. And then it's one of its generals saying they're going to be wiped out. And so we come to hear this from Iran, this type of terminology or this type of phraseology from Iran, and we become numb to it. But all the proof is there that they will intend, or they do intend, to eventually use all the armaments that they have against Israel.
Right, and Israel is certainly very aware of that, and they know what they're up against with Iran. And we've talked about just how much pressure Iran is putting on Israel right now, how much more desperate their position is getting. If people wanted more information about looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, the fact that Iran is making these kinds of provocative moves, where would you send them, Brent?
I would just read an article that was produced just last week by Anthony Chivariwe, one of our writers. It's entitled, "Iran is Targeting All of Us."
Thanks for that, Brent. So let's move over to America now. An article in Foreign Policy this week makes some concerning points. The title, America's Military is Choking on Old Technology. And the quip, which is interesting in light of what we've just been talking about, as its rivals invest in new military hardware, Washington is stuck refurbishing obsolete equipment. To learn more about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it is a fascinating piece. Obviously, the kind of the revival of the American military is in the news a lot right now with President Trump's State of the Union address. He wants to increase the defense budget and spend even more, making America's military the greatest on earth. But this this article in Foreign Policy by a team of defense analysts does make the point that, at least to a certain extent, the fact that America has the world's biggest or most expensive military means that it's spending billions and billions of dollars maintaining equipment that was very useful in fighting the last war, while some other nations with smaller budgets are doing arguably a better job investing in the type of weapons and the type of new technologies that could be used to fight the next war.
Technology changes quick.
Yeah, there is a saying, even in, I think, like West Point, as they said, every general fights the last war. The World War II generals were all trained on how to fight World War I. The Korean generals, they were all trained how to fight World War II. So it's a challenge to anticipate what's going to be needed in the future.
And when you just think about the type of technological changes that are taking place right now, you know, the fact that America's military is invested so heavily in technology that is maybe decades old, as we're entering deeper and deeper into asymmetrical threats, cyber threats, satellite technology, all of these types of things, where it's a little bit difficult to anticipate where that next threat is going to come. Your aircraft carrier or whatever large equipment that you've invested in a generation or two ago isn't necessarily going to help you in that.
Right. And at the Trump, I mean, we draw a lot of attention, especially to cyber warfare and to a little bit of a lesser extent, satellite warfare. This article talks about things like, well, they mention artificial intelligence, but also like autonomous vehicles, material science, nanotechnology, all these new things that nations are getting into that really could give you a huge advantage in a conflict. And I think one of the things that just really caught my attention reading through this is I'd just done an article for two issues of the Trumpet ago on America's retreat from global leadership that's going through this this very detailed prophecy in Micah 5. Well, the first 10 verses of that chapter just really build up what a great superpower, military superpower, the America and Britain, the end time nations of Israel, are going to be in the end time. But then in verse 10, it jumps into, and it says, "And it shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord, that I will cut off your horses from the midst of you, and I will destroy your chariots, and I will cut off your cities from your land and throw down your strongholds, and I will cut off witchcrafts out of thy hand, and you will have no more soothsayers." And in chapter 14 of Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, he talks about that this cutting off of the cities and the throwing down of the strongholds occurs when America's at the zenith of its power. So in some ways, it's not quite like the Roman Empire, where they were like in decline for two centuries before barbarians invaded their border. This prophecy in Hosea is like, says you're going to be like at the very pinnacle of your power, and then something's going to happen where it just all comes crashing down on your head because of the witchcraft and the soothsayers and the false religions and things and the other sins of the nation. And so just reading through this is that America's still got the world's biggest military. It's kind of hard to see how that's going to change anytime soon. But it could almost be a liability against you if the next war is fought with new technologies that you haven't even anticipated.
Right. This foreign policy article that you're drawing attention to, it talks about the fact that in World War I, they were saying They wanted to have the largest horse cavalry formations that they could have well into the 20th century, even though the evidence from World War I showed, having a cavalry charge on a modern battlefield was a ludicrous idea. But it quotes the last U.S. Army chief of cavalry who said, well, we always are going to have horses on the battlefield because when better roller skates are made, then cavalry horses will wear them.
Right.
so it's just interesting that the language in that prophecy that you cited is it's the language of biblical warfare. It's horses and chariots, and that God is going to strip those away, that those aren't going to be of any use in a modern battle. But it is, in a sense, it's the same kind of analogy here, that you're dealing with antiquated technology that doesn't help you in modern warfare.
Right. And I guess even a bigger picture, it's been a long time, but if you read back through some of the older American presidents, George Washington and Abraham Lincoln really pointed to the fact that war isn't won by force of arms or things like that. God decides who wins wars. And so you declare days of fasting and stuff like that to beseech God's help. Now you don't hear that type of talk nearly so much. It's more about, well, we're going to have the biggest, best military ever. But at the end of the day, if, like I said, you can get some of these groundbreaking technologies can really change the game very quickly if God isn't the one fighting your battles for you.
Well, thanks for that, Andrew. We'll go out now to Jeremiah Jacques for a bit more information on China and its efforts to take over the South China Sea.
Yes, in discussions about the South China Sea dispute, we very often hear about China claiming nearly the entire resource-rich and really strategic region. We also very often hear about rival claimants, countries like Vietnam and the Philippines, that dispute China's claims. International law says that these smaller nations rightfully own the portions of the sea that touch their coasts. So they, you know, very often cry foul of Beijing's claims to their territory. But there's one country with claims to part of the South China Sea that we really don't hear from very much at all in this context anymore, and that is Brunei. Brunei is on the northwestern coast of the island of Borneo, and its location right there on the southern end of the South China Sea means that Brunei can lawfully claim the 200 nautical mile patch of the sea off of its coast as its exclusive economic zone. And in previous decades, Brunei was clear about asserting its claims to this part of the South China Sea. The leadership would make public objections when they found China engaged in activities off their coasts and things like that. But in more recent years, Brunei has become virtually silent about these claims, in really sharp contrast to governments in Hanoi and Manila and places like that. The leadership in Brunei refrains from saying almost anything that's critical of Beijing right now. And it really looks like this is because China has essentially bought Brunei. They've funneled about $6 billion worth of investment into Brunei in recent years. And for a nation as small as Brunei, that's a vast amount of money. And that comes at a time when Brunei's main economic lifeline, which is oil, is really dwindling. Their oil reserves are dwindling. So this would come at a time when they're looking for revenue. And so it's clear that China has essentially bought Brunei with all this investment. And as a result, Brunei is basically silent now in the South China Sea dispute.
It's kind of amazing to think of China investing that much in a nation. I mean, we never hear about Brunei. It is a small country. Why do you suppose China's that interested in making sure that they've got Brunei in their pocket?
Well, I think a big part of it could be because Brunei is a member of ASEAN. That's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And that organization was established mainly to help the smaller nations in this region be able to stand up to China's influence. It was to sort of help them speak with one voice and to act with a measure of unity against China's influence. So the fact that China now has a great amount of sway over one of these members of ASEAN, Brunei, it really complicates the efforts of ASEAN and of the other members of this group.
So maybe you could just put this in context with China's larger ambitions within the region. It seems like kind of everything's going its way right now.
Yes. Yeah, they really are making incredible progress in taking over the South China Sea, whether it's with military power, such as the islands that we've spoken about several times that they've built there, or with soft power, like this that we see happening in Brunei. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that China's takeover of the South China Sea is steering the world toward war. In our July 2016 issue, he said, "Since Japan's defeat in World War II, America has protected this vital trade route and brought peace to this part of the world. Now, the American military is retreating and other great powers are coming in to fill the vacuum. China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. Everything is headed in the direction of war." And Mr. Fleury's understanding of this South China Sea dynamic is based on Bible prophecy. In that article, he mentions Deuteronomy 28, verse 52. In that passage, God warns the nations of Israel that if they reject him, then he'll hand control over the world's strategic sea gates to their enemies. And Mr. Fleury goes on to explain that this warning is actually for the modern nations of America and Britain. He says, quote, "It's a prophecy for the modern-day descendants of Israel. Two nations in particular represent Israel in this end time, America and Britain. This prophecy and several others show that he will send foreign enemies to punish America and Britain." So the fact that China has now essentially bought Brunei and just its general broader ongoing takeover of the South China Sea, it does show that the era of America bringing peace to this part of the world is rapidly ending, and it shows that this prophecy is now in the process of being fulfilled.
Thank you, Jeremiah. We're going to finish the program with a quick update how things are going in Germany's efforts to put together a coalition government. For this, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Not well. Last week, we talked about some of the obstacles. I think even while we were recording our show, Sigmar Gabriel, who we were talking about how he'd stepped down as party leader, was also forced to give up his consolation prize of becoming Germany's next foreign minister. So the left-wing Social Democratic Party is in absolute turmoil right now. They've kicked him out. There's a lot of anger building there. There was a poll yesterday that put them just one percentage point ahead of the Alternative for Deutschland, which is really shocking for them. I think it was something like their lowest ever rating in a poll. But meanwhile, Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Party, they are in turmoil as well. On Sunday, Angela Merkel was kind of forced to come out on TV and defend the coalition agreement. Her party is angry because she gave up all of the top jobs. And, one of them tweeted jokingly, it's a good job we managed to hang on to the chancellorship because they'd just given so much away, despite being the biggest party there.
Yeah.
Handelsblatt said that the party was livid. Spiegel talked about a potentially revolutionary fury. There's a lot of talk about plots and people wanting to try and get rid of Angela Merkel. Spiegel yesterday, they had a really excellent article where they wrote that Germany could be close to a meltdown of Germany's party system with far-reaching consequences. So you're just seeing this whole story continue to build. And just as we've talked about all along, the Bible talks exactly about the rise of a strong, undemocratic leader in Germany. And you're seeing exactly the kind of atmosphere building that could bring that about. And so you can read more about that in our free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. And that will take you through the scriptures that we use and why we're expecting this for Germany, right as you see it happening before your eyes.
All right, well, that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed today, including the one Richard just mentioned, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. Let me know what you thought of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be
thanks
here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Will Durant. The first condition of freedom is its limitation. Make it absolute and it dies in chaos. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.